Om
Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Sorry, do you want to chant from the Shamadhi Sadhana Sampatti Ka? That's where we should start.
Mm-hmm.
And then just go. To the bottom of page 9, just chant this whole thing. Yeah, it's the whole Shamadhi.
Okay.
Then we'll go through slowly.
Shamadhi sadhana,
Shamadhi sadhana,
Sampattika,
Sampattika,
Samaha,
Samaha,
Dhammaha,
Dhammaha,
Dharamaha,
Uparamaha,
Diksha,
Diksha,
Shraddha,
Shraddha, Samadhanam Cheti Shamakkaha Manonigraha
Tamakkaha
Tamakkaha
Chakshuradi
Chakshuradi
Vahendriyani
Vahendriyani
Nigraha
Nigraha
Bahendriya, Bahendriya, Nigraha.
Bahendriya,
Bahendriya,
Nigraha,
Nigraha,
Uparamakaha,
Uparamakaha,
Swadharmanushthanam,
Swadharmanushthanam, Eva. Shaka
Shitoshna
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 Sukhadukhadi
Sukhadukhadi
Sahishnutvam
Sahishnutvam
Shraddha
Shraddha
Kidrshi
Kidrshi
Guru
Guru
Vedanta
Vedanta
Vakyeshu
Vakyeshu
Vakyadishu
Vakyadishu
Vishvasaha
Vishvasaha
Shraddha
Shraddha.
You might not get this far. You might. No. Okay. So for the sadhana chatushtayam, this fourfold group of sadhanas for the antakarna shuddhi, these qualities of mind that we're looking at as sadhanas, dispositions for the mind so that it is available to gain this knowledge through shravana manana nidhyasana becomes the means for gaining the knowledge, but the upayanishta requires certain qualities. The mind requires the antakarana, the mind requires certain qualities and dispositions in order to be available to receive that knowledge. So this is the list. And so the first question is this: Shamadhi sadhana sampattihi ka. What is this collection, this wealth, this what does it mean to have these sadhanas, these means, beginning with shama? Remember when you have shama adi, it's like saying shama, etc. So what are they? What is the sixfold wealth? Shamadi shatka sampattihi, this group of six qualities and dispositions, beginning with shama, that really become the sadhana for the mind to be able to receive this knowledge. So the first thing he does is just list them. So shamaha, dhammaha, uparamaha, titiksha, shraddha, samadhanam, cha iti, cha and. Let's put some in quotes. These are what they are. The question, what are these? These are what they are. That's the iti. Cha. In Sanskrit, the cha, which means and, it usually often comes at the end of a group. So instead of saying shama and dhamma and uparama and titiksha and shraddha and samadhanam, it just says the list and puts cha at the end. That's the most common. So you see cha, iti, comes at the very end. And that's just saying, this is the group. So this is the list. Shama, dhamma, uparama, titiksha, shraddha, samadhanam. What do they mean? What do these words mean? Let's go to the next page. Taking one at a time, one word at a time. Shamaha kaha. Shama is masculine. Nominative singular. Shamaha kaha. What is shama? What do we mean by shama? And so, next line he says. So just repeat after me so you can get used to it. Shamaha kaha.
Shamaha kaha.
What is shama? Mano nigraha.
Mano nigraha.
It's a compound from manas. The word for manaha, the substantive, the word itself, pratipadika, is manaha, manas. And so that manas will take the sandhi o in a compound, so mano nigraha. It's a compound. Now, this word, nigraha, it usually means like control, or mastery, or suppression. It has all of these type of means, or even destruction it has. But here by nigraha, we don't want to destroy the mind. And also, it's not enough to control the mind. So Swamiji, in his book, uses a nice word, the resolution of the mind, and then takes nigraha in the sense, instead of thinking of control or destruction or repression or suppression or any of these types of mastery, he has a much gentler way of defining shama that is actually, I think, much more realistic to what shama actually is. So if you see the definition here in your little booklet, he says, mano nigraha, mastery over the mind, the ways of thinking, mastery over the ways of thinking. So mastery is also a little bit more gentle than control, because mastery means you have learned how to be with the mind, right? In such a way that the mind is available to you. I think shama, that's the main understanding with shama. Shama is not so much at all about what types of emotions or thoughts or feelings that arise in the mind, or about what the thought flow that is taking place in the mind. It really has to do more with the difficult emotions normally, the more difficult emotions or thoughts or reactions that arise in the mind that really stop it from being available to me, right? If the mind can be stopped in its tracks through anger or through upset or through hurt feelings or through depression or through sorrow and different types of suffering that take place, or agitations, you know. So when these emotions come up, the question is, how am I naturally with them? When these emotions come up, is it that, say, a sad emotion comes up And then there is really nobody home. If the sad emotion comes up, there's nobody at home to be with that. And then I simply am sad, and then I find myself acting out in the world as a sad person. Or an emotion arises, and remember we in the meditation, or we've talked about these emotions really as products. They either rise up from the unconscious, something has produced them. You can't tell them to rise or not rise. You know, you're not there. You're not there to make that judgment in the unconscious when it bubbles up. It is there. Right? And so if there is no one home, if the buddhi is not there to be with that, whatever is arising, then I am that. It overwhelms the mind, like the sadness overwhelms the mind, or the agitation or the anger. And so I am angry. Okay? Now when I say I am angry, that's going to bring in Dhamma. I am angry, and so are you going to be the recipient of that anger? This is another issue, right? Because that shama to be there, it has to be there. That sounds kind of silly to say. the emotions and the whole spectrum, especially of the negative emotions, has to rise into a buddhi which is present. A present to that emotion, which means that there is a viveka there. There's a subject-object relation there. The buddhi is there to receive that emotion and to handle it. That's shama. To handle it in such a way that the mind can go on functioning. That the mind, the buddhi, is available to you. It's available to do your work. It's available to socialize. It's available to study. It's available, a functioning antakarana that is using your sense organs and organs of action in order to do whatever you want to do, actually. It's just available to you to use. And so when that's the case, we say that person as the shama is there. The shama is there, operational. Okay, what that means then is that, say, an anger arises in me. It's arising into a buddhi that knows how to be with that anger. So already that identification is not there, right? Like, oh, the anger has come. This anger has come. If I get angry or something like that, frustrated or something, we all have maybe our little mantras that we might say to that little, from these little English little phrases that might be useful. One for me that's always been useful is if some sort of hurt feeling or irritation comes up, I don't usually say something unless I can easily just kind of let it go, if it wants to stick a little bit, you know. So what is that really about, you know? What am I really angry about? That's a really interesting question, because actually it's usually nothing to do with out here. What is really hurting my feelings? Why am I so hurt? But see, to be able to say that, it's coming up into somebody who can say that, right? That's shama. So that these hurts and pains, and you could say like this even, the internal situations that arise, as well as the external situations that arise, there's somebody there to be with that, you know? And so the mind is not really in a position to just overwhelm you, because it comes into somebody who is with you, right? If that subject-object relationship between your buddhi, and you can say yourself, your buddhi, which is rooted in yourself, if that subject-object relationship is there, then there's somebody to help you. There's somebody to be with that anger right away, you know? And so that becomes your sadhana, and you just get used to that. Now, say you get used to that, and that is what normally happens. Your thoughts are just innocently moving along, and your mind is highly functional and just doing what it wants to do. Your mind is operating as a mind, as we want it to, like a healthy mind. It's doing what's to be done. If different reactions and whatnot come up, they're not overwhelming so that I become that. It's a reaction I still have a subject-object relationship with, and I can use my tools and my understanding to neutralize that and to help it and to actually grow. Because some unconscious material has come up, I can be with it in a way that really helps me to grow. That's why we call it a sadhana. I can be with that in a helpful way. When the... So that's the shama. That's what we mean. So just to bring this together. So when we say the resolution of the mind, they mean the resolution of the manas. The buddhi needs to resolve the manas. The emotions, negative emotions, are really stored in the manas. So the buddhi, being with those as they arise, is shama. The educated buddhi, the buddhi who has those skills, the skills we call kaushalam, a little aside, when we start to really talk about the karma yoga has really two, in a way, two prongs. One prong has two sides. The one prong for karma yoga is what we call Ishvara Arpana Buddhi, where I'm able to recognize all of my actions, everything I do is really a worship of Bhagavan. If I'm talking to you, the way I talk to you is the way, with the same love, the respect that I would talk to Ishvara. I see you only as part and parcel of Ishvara, and the way that I treat you is the way I treat Bhagavan. That's Arpana. Arpana is that worship. So if I want, I mean, once I really understand everything as Ishvara, I treat everything as Ishvara. Everything, everyone, as Bhagavan. That's Ishvara Arpana Buddhi. For the mumukshu, that becomes a sadhana. Right? That becomes the value. It's not necessarily absolutely natural to me, you know, because I don't have the... my mind isn't totally absorbed into my knowledge at this point. It's a great sadhana, though, because when I come to this knowledge, perhaps I have some shraddha in Ishvara, you know. And so if I have shraddha and devotion and commitment to Bhagavan, then I just treat everybody like they're Bhagavan. It's a way of being. That's half of this one side of the problem. We'll talk about this in a lot of depth, and we have in the Bhagavad Gita also for those of going to Mangalam. The other side of the prong is prasada buddhi. How do I receive what's coming to me? This is how I act toward the world. How do I receive the world? All of the things that come my way, prasada buddhi. This is all for a gift from Bhagavan. You know? It may not feel like a gift, but it is. It is a gift in its not being a gift. It not being a gift for you is kind of like, I don't want this. This is not what I was asking for. Mm-hmm. And the gift of that is that allows you to gain that attitude, you know, to receive what comes my way as prasada. When I receive, if the only things I receive as prasada, that, you know, that as coming from Ishvara, the only things I receive are the things I want. This is prasad, this is prasad. What the heck is this? That's samsara. So then, if you want that attitude, then we just say, okay, we're committed to samsara. That's it. I like these things. Bhagavan, please give me all of these things. I've shraddha on you, but give me the things I want. That's what I pray for. And that's what I want you to do. I want you to help me by giving me the things that I want and keep away the things that I don't want. That is a devotion. That's a bhakti. That's a type of bhakti. You know? Yeah. But for, it's not the bhakti of a mumukshu. The bhakti of a mumukshu is, let me abide in this knowledge. Let me know you. And let me never not know you. You know? And let me, and as I mature in this knowledge, you know, let me know the reality, the tattva bodha, the meaning. Please let me know. Help me. Bhagavan says, okay. That means there's a lot of little work to be done. It's a lot of work to be done because, saying that a little bit facetiously, but not really, there's a lot of work to be done. There's something to know, and then there's assimilation of that knowledge. The knowing, there's only the mind's being present to the knowledge. If you have that guru, if that guru sisha, we'll see if that guru sisha relationship is there, and your mind is available, then there is nothing to do except get yourself to class. That's them doing. Get yourself to class, sit down, direct your sense organs toward the Bach, toward the teaching. That's it. But then to have a mind, even to get yourself to the teaching, you would have a mind that has this sadhana chatushtya, these fourfold qualities, to a good degree, or you wouldn't have any interest in coming. But then there's still some work to be done. It's on unconscious things, there are habits, there are our own disposition, the way we were raised, trauma, so many little things. We really need to learn how to be with all of that so that they can, those pains and those hurts, like a broken arm, all these pains and hurts need to come to a certain resolution. They need to come to a certain resolution just for me to be available totally to this teaching. And then for my mind to have that sense that that mind is an expression of Ishvara and not an expression of the Jiva Srishti. That the mind is an expression of Ishvara Srishti. Just a little quickie on that. Ishvara Srishti means Bhagavan's, Ishvara's creation. This is Ishvara's creation. Everything that you experience, that it exists at all, is Ishvara. And so, this, in fact, this whole creation is Ishvara's creation. But then why do we say Ishvara's creation, the Ishvara Srishti, versus Jiva Srishti? Why do we have these two? Ishvara's creation, the Jiva Srishti, the Jiva's creation. If everything's Ishvara's creation. Well, even though absolutely everything is Ishvara's creation, some of the creation arises out of the jiva. It is rooted in the jiva. It is rooted in the ajnanam, the self-ignorance of the jiva. Now, if you look at it, you have a body, you have a mind, you have sense organs, you have an unconscious, you know, you have the buddhi, you have the manas, the fluctuating mind, the one that holds all of the negative emotions. You know, you have the chitta, you have the memory, you have the ahankara, you have these four functions of the mind. So you have a mind, you have prana, you have the organs of the sense organs and the organs of action. Bhagavan has given this to all of us, especially as humans. Human beings get this special quality of being, of self-reflection, you know, of self-reflection, of having some extraordinary amount of free will. You know, these are all. This is all Ishvara. The upadis that you have, those upadis are Ishvara. But then there's some free will there too. And so these upadis, this body, mind, sense organs, is able to fill up that unconscious, is able to fill up the memory banks with their own experiences and their own reactions. That we can have experiences and that we can have reactions, it's all Ishvara. That there is such a thing as anger and these common things, like if I say the word anger, you know, that's something that everyone understands this word. If I say sorrow or hurt or agitation or love or compassion, we all understand this word, but we have our own unique experiences. Compassion is the compassion, the anger is the anger, but it has arisen from in our mind, sense organs, and within our prarabdha karma. You see what I mean? So that these exist is Bhagavan. That we have our own version and our own situations which have produced all of these products is the jiva srishti. Is the jiva's creation, even though everything's coming out of that jiva creation, belongs to Ishvara. There's nothing outside of Ishvara, but if it's rooted in the individual ajnanam of the jiva, then we call it jiva srishti. And what is so interesting about it, as we'll be seeing, that ajnanam that is there naturally for every jiva, for every antakarana, in terms of self-knowledge, you can't eliminate, you can't become a sarvajnaha like Ishvara, well, sarvavit, you can be not a sarvavit where everything is known, because the mind is not infinite in terms of size. You don't have an infinite buddhi, but this sarvajnatvam used in this way, the gaining, the removal of that ignorance and gaining self-knowledge is what we can all have or not have. It is available to us. And when that ajnanam is removed, when that self-ignorance is removed, our relationship changes quite a bit. Just by the mere fact of removing that ajnanam, our relationship to this, to Ishvara, changes. Our relationship to Ananda changes. The relationship to Raga Dvesha, our likes and dislikes, change significantly. You know, that significantly, and I recognize that the Ananda that I seek in the world is my own self. And there really is no distance between my mind, my buddhi, and that Ananda. That this self that I am is the self of every being. I know every being intimately. I know who you are because you are myself. Your being is myself. I know who Ishwar is because this innermost self that I am is the very innermost self of Ishwara. So I am always with Ishwara. Yeah. There is no reason, you know. There's nothing for me to do, really. As a Jivanmukta, there's really nothing for me to do because all of it is being done. The whole creation is a dance. The whole Prarabdha Karma is a dance. It is all being done. And I'm happy that this is what Ishwara is doing. I can relax and be with that and do my dharma, and I can do my dharma easily because I'm already happy. Because I don't need the world to be in a particular way so that I can be happy, so I can be with the world as it is. So there's tremendous freedom in the mityatva, in the relegation to mitya or to not being essential in any way to your being or to your fullness of all your raga dveshas. All of your likes and dislikes, they're irrelevant, really. They're irrelevant to your well-being. Yeah. If you recognize they're irrelevant to your well-being. But that's jnanam, that's self-knowledge. You recognize they're irrelevant to your well-being because the ananda that you place upon them is simply a projection. They have no ananda. You are the ananda that is projected onto them. And what if you don't want to project onto them anymore? What if you see that as absolutely a futile pursuit that has no reality to it whatsoever? So now it projects anyway because of some scars. If it's a non-binding desire, you say, okay, that's good, we'll try for that. If it's a binding desire, your mind will say, oh, no. I'm not going to go through all of the dukkha that these binding desires cause. Shama. That is shama. So shama, the shama dhamma becomes very natural. Shama becomes very natural because your mind loses its desire for having things a certain way so that you can be happy. Needing your mind to be a certain way so you can be happy. If the mind is unhappy, if some negative emotion comes up, it's not really much different than if your friend is unhappy and suffering, irritated. You know? Your child. I we're so lucky to have our little ones here. Because you can see the love and the shanti and the welcoming of the little ones, no matter what situation they find themselves in. They could be crying or whiny or so upset or so disturbed or so this or so that, you know. And you remain with that shanti to take care of them. We have that externally, but internally it becomes that way for you and for your life and for everything, because you're not at stake. Your well-being is simply not at stake and not in question, right? So that's the beauty your mind naturally, with knowledge, it naturally matures into this shama, because your buddhi is always in a position to help. Swamiji once said, I love this, and it's something he says sometimes in teaching and meditation. The buddhi of the jnani, really, in terms of the world, if it's going to be anything other than just enjoying Ishwar, you're called to do something. You're called, it's, how can I help? How can I contribute to this? What can I do? How can I contribute to this? What can I do? You know, that's all it is. Because there's nothing inside that's at stake or needs to get anything particular out of it. And that's not because of a discipline. That's because that you already have the ananda that you're seeking. And so you don't have to have a special type of animal cracker. All the different animal crackers are all graham cracker, and it's all wonderful. There is no problem. You don't need a particular graham cracker, animal cracker. They're all good. So the shama is something that we naturally evolved into, but part of it is that alertness, you know, to coming into relationship with the problems. And I think that our learning how to do inner child work allows that, where we really are practicing that subject-object relationship, coming to those little ones with that type of love and kindness, and also that welcoming and... like an ultimate positive regard. Carl Rogers is one psychologist of the past, but he used to have this positive regard, this ultimate positive regard. In that positive regard, there's never wavering, and so you have that positive regard toward all the little children. It's so easy for us to have that, so natural, but then toward all of the things. Think of all the little children that are rising up, having their own little temper tantrums and their own hurts and sadness, all rising up. Do you have that positive regard and that welcoming, trying to help? That really is shama, because the buddhi remains, and the buddhi always remains operational. So that's what we call shama. It's not about really control, you know, or destruction, or punishment, you know, or losing that positive regard. Losing that positive regard is, I'm not a good person, you know, or thinking, oh, I'm no longer a good person because this thought has come up. Or you would never think that about a child. You're having a temper tantrum, you're not a good person. Mm-hmm. It's impossible. It's just, it's absolutely ridiculous. Even think, you can't even imagine. In fact, it's you don't even want an imagination like that. And so you have to realize that toward internally also. It's very beautiful. And so let's go on to the next one. So, dhammaha kaha. Say,
dhammaha kaha.
Chakshuradi.
Chakshuradi.
Mahendriya.
Mahendriya.
Nigraha.
Nigraha.
Chakshuhu?
Chakshuhu.
Okay, yeah, we can say it. I'm breaking the Sunday. Okay, we'll all break the Sunday together. Chakshuhu?
Chakshuhu.
Adi?
Adi.
Bahya?
Bahya.
Indriya?
Indriya.
Nigraha?
Nigraha.
So remember, you have a word like chakshus followed by adi takes the rakara. So chakshuradihi. So not adihi, this is a compound, but chakshu, chakshus, adi, chakshuradi, compound. The sakara becomes repha. Chakshus, adi. Remember, adi means beginning with the eyes. Chakshu means eyes. So you have adi after the first member of a group. So here the group is, they're starting it with chakshu, means the five sense organs. So bahya, indriya, nigraha. Here nigraha does have a more sense of control or mastery, not destruction, but more of a control or being able to hold in your hands. It's nigraha. Now this says, this bahyendriya. The word indriya means sense, the organs. It means organs. So in reference to the mind and sense organs, right? So the bahyendriyas are the external organs. The external organs. Whereas the antakarana is the internal instrument, right? So the karanas can also mean the sense organs. Indriyas, karanas, the instruments of actions or the instruments. So here, bahya means external. So the sense organs are external in the sense that their realm is external, right? So outside of the mind uses these indriyas to perceive the physical world, including this body. This body is also perceived by the sense organs. So the external, it's the five sense organs that perceive the external world. And then there's also the indriyas, which are the external indriyas, are the indriyas, the organs of action. So let's see, go into that here. Not so much. But they're also the organs of action, like your speech, for instance, vak. Or your ability to grasp. We'll get into this in detail later. Your ability to grasp, or your ability to walk, you know, your movement, your sexuality also. So these are the external ways, what things you can do with your body. So I'm going to include those here in terms of Dhamma. So it's control of the external indriyas, where Shama is control really of the mind. Control means the resolution, bringing it into a space, being able to always bring the mind in to resolve it, to resolve the problems, you know, to calm it down when it's not operational. You'd be able to calm it down. That's Shama, it's working with the mind. Dhamma is sometimes Swamiji will say tongue in cheek, when Shama fails, like for instance, an example, when Shama fails, some anger has risen up, and it's a biggie. It's a big one. And it has knocked off the buddhi. So it's not rising up into the buddhi. The buddhi just as though becomes overwhelmed by the tidal wave of that anger. Okay. So now what are you going to do? It's not as though there's anybody really present to contain that anger and to do this nice subject-object work. You are an angry person. Say, I'm angry. I am so angry. Okay. Now here you are. Or the other person, say you're in a group, you know, or you're with another person and something happens and you're so angry that you could immediately blurt out who knows what. Usually, whenever we do that, we kind of wish we hadn't done that. But in the heat of that passion, it comes out, you know. And in the heat of the passion, the other person might also, in the heat of their passion, some anger or rage or agitation or unkindness, you know, because you feel unkind. You feel unkind and they deserve your unkindness. Bam! Just like vomiting or something. You know? So Dhamma is meant, how do you handle this situation? Anger is a good one to work with. How do you handle it? You feel so angry. You learn how to say something because now you have enough sense left to know I need to leave this situation because nobody home. So your buddhi tucked away in a little corner says, leave the situation. And you hear, I'm supposed to leave the situation. So then you say something like, I'm really feeling upset, I'm feeling anger. Let me just go for some time and then we'll talk later. Because you're acknowledging, obviously you're angry because it's just coming out of your body. Your body's overwhelmed by it. But if you say, you know, I'm feeling upset, I'm feeling anger, I'm so angry, I just let me go be with myself for some time and then we will talk. And so then you can remove yourself from the situation and you can go relieve yourself of that anger. I was reading Swamiji's book on this which you will all get soon. I didn't ask you to really spend time reading it. The things are so beautiful about his book. All the things, these are all examples that as I'm reading, I remember. Yeah, you see. This is one that's an example in his Dhamma. He used to say this, okay, get a wet towel. Get a wet towel, you know? Mm-hmm. And then slam that wet towel like on the, in the bathroom on the tile floor. Just slam it down because it'll make a big, huge noise, you know? Oh, just a dry towel won't make enough noise. So get a wet towel and just slam it down, you know? Or go out into the woods, into a place where people can't hear you. He said, let all the trees hear you, let the wind hear you, let the sun hear you. But, you know, remove yourself quite a ways from others so that they won't be exposed to it. Anything you some say in the cities, as a therapist or psychologist will say that you can always take a ride in the car, you know, and then roll down the windows, go slowly into, you know, away from people and just scream it out or shake it out. Go into a good thing that we kind of learn in martial arts and things like that, and yoga and tai chi. Even in working with patients who are very emotionally disturbed, psychotic type people, or people who are just totally overwhelmed with whatever it is that is hurting them, just shake it out like that. So you're just shaking it out of your body. So you do things that work for you, or go swimming, or go for a run until you work up a big sweat, you know. Do things that can physically release you of all of the chemicals, you know, that are pulsating through your body that anger or that strong negative emotion has released. It releases so much in the whole body, and you have to shake it out and dance it out or swim it out or run it out or scream it out. Tell you. Okay. And then when you're ready and have some objectivity, then you go back and talk to the person. And that's true with irritation or where you think the person is an idiot. My God. They can't even do that correctly. That really, those kind of thoughts really require some Dhamma. It's somebody inside that little buddhi has to say that it's really not a kind thought. Mm-hmm. That is really mean. That thought is mean. Yeah. You need to go away for a while. Because it's very hurtful thoughts. The very thoughts and emotions that come up that if they were said to you would really hurt you. Those, that's the key. You know, that's the Dharma, the ahimsa. If it would hurt you, you know, it's going to really hurt the other person, and then you also will be hurt. You will both be hurt. Because you can't hurt another person without yourself being hurt. You can't be angry at another person without yourself being angry. And so these things, we have to walk away, you know, work on those things, and then come back, you know, and say satin, which is basically ahimsa. It's satin that is objective. You know. So that becomes a very, very important, because to the degree that we act out, to that degree, our mind also is suffering. We suffer as much as the person we're angry at. We suffer as much as the person that we hurt. It's not that the hurt, that we release the hurt. We don't release the hurt. We share the hurt. We just pass it on. Now we both hurt. Now we're both upset. Now we're both angry, you know. And so now we have made it twice as big as it was before. So you have to think about all of this to get a value, you know, for best to walk away. And if the other person is really upset or really frustrated or really angry, and they're starting to expel all of that, then we can say, you're really angry. Let's talk another time. Let's just separate. We'll talk at another time when all of these emotions aren't flying. You say to the other person, that spares them also. It kind of gives them a relief. There's somebody here to handle the situation, you know, so that the other person also now is not subject to the very painful nature of those negative explosions. So you say, let's wait. And then when you're both normal, when the mind is available to you and the buddhi is available, then to be able to talk to each other from a more objective place, you know. So this isn't, like running away or swallowing. It's not that, you know. Like, we don't run away from your emotions. If you're angry, be angry. No. If you're angry, be angry by yourself. And deal with it, you know. If you're frustrated, be frustrated by yourself and have the tools to really deal with it, to shake it out, and then come back and deal with the situation. And do that kind act to another person also. If they're really frustrated or angry or, you know, spewing, help them. You just become a buddhi. Your buddhi. We say this in therapy. You give them your buddhi, so now their buddhi has some extra strength. When you can calmly say, you know, you're so upset. Let's talk about this later. When you're feeling more calm, we're both calm, then we talk about it. That's Dhamma. And it's a beautiful quality. When that comes up, then, because it wasn't there initially, this is the difference between Shama and Dhamma. It wasn't there initially for the anger or resentment to rise up into that helpful buddhi. Right? The emotion rose up, overwhelmed you, you know, and ready to act out. So then you have the wherewithal to stop that acting out. And once you stop, you know, you're not going to act out like that. It gives the buddhi a chance to come back into the picture and bring its helpfulness there, and then you can deal with it. The difference between Shama and Dhamma is, one, the loss of control over the overwhelm doesn't take place because it comes into that mind that has Shama and immediately can come into relationship with it and work on it and deal with it, as opposed to this onslaught of emotions, you know, coming up and overwhelming us. And then we have to get away, shake it out, whatever we have to do. Those are all tools that we have and come into a relationship with it to see what is really making you so hurt or so angry or so upset or so dejected. Tell me what that is. But you say that just like we would say to your little child, tell me what's going on, you know, with love. That's a beautiful thing. Okay, so that's those two. Let's do Upadamaha. We have time for that. Upadamaha kaha. So Sandhi Upadamak kaha. Upadamak. The Visarga goes to the kind of the Upadmaniya kind of.
Do Jihua
Mulya. Padmaniya is for the part. Jihua Mulya means it's kind of stops in your throat. Yeah. Upadamakaha. You can feel it there in the back of the tongue, the root of the tongue. Okay, so what is Upadamaha? Swadharma anishtanam eva. Say swa. Swadharma.
Swadharma.
Anishtanam.
Anishtanam.
Eva.
Yeah. Okay.
This is actually an unusual definition of upadama. So I'm going to say the two that we usually use, and then I'll include this one first. Swadharma means one's own dharma. One's own dharma means one's own duties as they present themselves in your prarabdha karma as life goes on. What is expected? What is expected of you in any given situation? What is your dharma in that situation? That's swadharma. Anushtanam means the practice of that. Practice or commitment, the practice of doing your dharma as opposed, in any given situation, as opposed to, you know, evading it, running away from it, or decide blowing it off. I know, but no, I'm not going to do it. No. Running away from what's expected of you, the duties that are expected of you. And so that's that's just a very simple life, really. As the universe, as the prarabdha karma unfolds, the karmas that brought you here, as moment by moment they're unfolding, you have certain, there are certain things expected of you, and those, that's what you do. You do what's expected of you, and that's your dharma. And so there's free will and things to do within that, but you're fulfilling the expectations of your own dharma. The Bhagavan put you in the situation, you know, things are asked of you in this situation, and those things that are asked of you, which are asked of you by Ishwara, not by, hey, let's blow this off and scoot out of here. One of your friends said, let's get out of here. You didn't have to do any of this. Not that. No. Ishwara puts you in a situation. That's the prarabdha karma. Situation continually is unfolding. And so, what is expected of you in these situations? That's your dharma. The anishtanam, only doing that, anishtanam eva. The only doing yearns for dharma, that's called uparama. Another meaning of uparama is sannyasa. Uparama, sometimes you'll see this as upartihi. So uparama, upartihi means the same. Sannyasa, because as a mumukshu, your dharma as a mumukshu is really the teaching and contemplation and satsang. That's what the life is. Either you're a student, you know, studying, doing the shravana, manana, nididhyasana, working on the upaya, upaya, nishta. That is what you do. So being exposed to, as the teacher, as a sannyasi, if you're the teacher, then that's what you teach, you know. You contemplate in whatever way that you do, just but basically teaching and satsang, that's your job, that's what you do. As an adhikari, somebody, an adhikari, qualified student who has taken sannyasa, then your life is simply devoted to the shravan, to teaching, to gain this teaching, contemplation, satsang, and katana, yourself discussing with other students, you know, in discussion. So that, and teaching the ones who are coming later than you. And when we went to that three-year course with Swamiji, and for, I think in mine in the 70s and other ones I went to, he always did that. He always, as this new people came in, or say, for instance, in Sanskrit, some loved Sanskrit, studied it all the time, and others would fall behind, you know, very normal. Most people would fall behind. And then, because I didn't have that Sanskrit vasana, you know, whatever. So the students would fall behind. And so some of the students who are not behind would teach those students. They would have groups. And so there would always be teaching going on for the students as one fell behind or a new person coming. Also, say, sometimes with the Swamiji in a three-year course, somebody comes in quite late. You know, Swamiji accepts them. But they've come in quite late. And so then there are other more students who have been there for much longer that will come to their aid and teach them. You know? And kind of a satsang katanam. I think that's what they do. It's very beautiful, actually. It's very good for the students because there's somebody to help them, to kind of catch them up, you know. And then those advanced students also are teaching, which is, it's a blessing. Teaching is always a blessing. You know, Swamiji would say, and in my own life, I always found this, even if you don't know very much, teach what you do know. And it just continually grow. Teaching, you grow through teaching. Don't be afraid to not know something. You teach what you know. What you don't know, you say, you know, let me look into it. I'll find out. You teach what you know. And then that gives you nishta in this knowledge, because it turns out, you know, with these courses and all, you're taking in, you know, like a tidal waves of knowledge. It's all pouring in, with very little chances to give that back out. But it's the giving it back out that makes you own it. It makes it become yours. So if you don't have the opportunity, if it doesn't arise for you, that opportunity to give it out, you can write it out. You can do something to make it come out. You can write a book. You can take very elaborate notes, writing all of your thoughts, and later on, as you gain more and more knowledge, you can use that and make it into whatever it's that process of being able to give it out. So when we say that upadama is sannyasa, it's because sannyasa is your dharma. If you were to take sannyasa or brahmacharya, you have moved in the Vedic religion. In the Vedas, you have moved into another stage of life, and this is the dharma of that life. This is what you do. You go out and do something else, that's really not your dharma. You know, I'm a sannyasi, but you know, I was running this business over here. Sannyasa, shravana manana nididhyasana, you're the teacher or you're the student, you have a contemplative life, you have satsang, you do katana, and that's your life. That's it. So, now if you look at as a lay person, we define upadama, then we define like this. That you are able as a person in the world to stay with a subject. Say you're interested in a subject. Maybe you're interested, maybe you have a love for botany, study of plants. But to master any subject is 12 years. So you can have, I'm really interested in this, you know, for 3 weeks or 3 months or 6 months. That's not enough to gain mastery. So the question is whether it's botany or music or astrology or Vedanta, the mind has to have the ability to stick with something. You're not a gadfly. You know what a gadfly is? A gadfly, derogatory term, the common term, is somebody who just is subject copying all the time. A little interested in this, they study it for a little while. Get some cursory knowledge of it. Then they go over here, and then they go over here, and then they go over here, but they don't have, their mind is not able to really sit in a subject matter to gain depth. And in the Vedanta, in gaining this knowledge, a gadfly doesn't, that won't do it. You know, there's a very deep commitment there. And the mind wants to gain that mastery. And here by mastery means you gain those two limbs, the upayanishta, you have a commitment to the shravana manana nididhyasana of the teaching, and you have equally a commitment to the antakarna shuddhi. You know, and gaining that karma yoga buddhi, which is, you see in the Bhagavad Gita even in chapter 2, this karma yoga buddhi is so close to the buddhi of the jnani. Because what is still some subject, object, the devotee, Ishwara, and the devotee duality is there for the mumukshu until it isn't. But that still, as a devotee, my whole life is a worship of Ishwara and receiving everything as prasada. Kaushalam, I forgot to say, was that other thing. That kaushalam is gaining skill in the world, your skills in being able to handle your unconscious, skill to do inner child work, skill to work with your imagination, skill to have shama and dhamma. These are skills. They involve some practice. Skills to be able to handle other people in a way that everybody feels blessed. These are skills. There's something that we have to learn that, you know, they come in time. We mature in that way in time, you know. That's called kaushalam. How to handle the more difficult situations. How to handle my own mind. That is kaushalam. So on the one hand, we have the Ishvara Arpana Buddhi, seeing everything as a worship of Bhagawan, and Prasada Buddhi, where we receive everything as prasad. And on this hand, we have these skills in order to really handle this knowledge. And the mind. And my little ones. And other people.
Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.
One thing I forgot to say about our groups, a couple things, is that I was only just stressing